Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmursday, May 30th, 2022. On the show today, we've got news and listener questions. Then in our main segment, Jim gives us the history of Walter Cronkite's narration of Spaceship Earth, as well as other celebrity appearances in Epcot. And don't forget that Walter Cronkite's narration began back in May of 1986. Let's get started by bringing in the man who says that he has the world's worst thesaurus. Not only is it terrible, but it's terrible. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
As an English major, yes, I expect more of my thesaurus. When I'm thinking terrible, I want it to be dreadful, frightful, ghastly, gruesome, harrowing. To just get terrible. See, terrible is just...
Terrible. It's really
terrible.
It's just not good.
Yeah. It's not good.
All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout out to subscribers over at disneydish.bandcamp.com. Thanks to new subscribers Janie Janeo, Joshua Intrilligator, and Paul Lanham, and the longtime subscribers Keldar, Unsupervised, and STL Mouse. Jim, back when Mickey Mouse was in a snow globe as part of the afternoon Share a Dream Come True parade, these were the cast members who had to carry emergency fire extinguishers and Gatorade. And although Mickey never burst into flames, it got close a couple of times, giving the team their nickname, the Smoldering Rodents. True story, Jim. True story.
I saw those guys open for Huey Lewis in the news once.
Wasn't that like the name that the Clash had like before Big Audio Dynamite?
There we go. There we go.
All right, Jim, let's do the news. Folks, the Disney Dish News is brought to you by Storybook Destinations, trusted travel partner of the Disney Dish Podcast. For a worry-free travel experience every time, book online at storybookdestinations.com. Jim, prices for individual lightning lanes for Guardians of the Galaxy are out. It's $14 per rider starting today. Thanks to our friend Scott Gustin for that information. A couple of other tips around riding Guardians of the Galaxy. If you can't get an individual lightning lane right at 7 a.m., try at 7:10 or 7:20. And there's a technical reason for this, and that's that behind the scenes, Disney's using a shopping cart piece of software to hold reservations. And if you don't complete those purchases within 10 minutes, say because Disney's website has crashed, those reservations go back into inventory. So people who tried at 7 a.m. and had a crash, those things will revert back at 7:10. Same thing at 7:20 for those people who crashed at 7:10. But 7:10, 7:11, 7:12, somewhere in there is the time to keep going. Also, if you want to improve your odds of getting a boarding group, Google the phrase Joel, J-O-E-L, and the letters BG and the number 1. So Joel, BG, 1, and then follow the directions. That's all we're going to say on this show.
Okay. On a recent episode of Marvel Us Disney, I shared some information I got from a friend at Imagineering that some of the footage that was shot for Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind was shot while Thor Love and Thunder was being shot in Australia. Just this morning, James Gunn, the director of all three of the Guardians films, and Cosmic Rewind reached out to say, no, that story's incorrect. I mean, who's really sweet about it? I mean, he could have come after me as being a complete jerk, but I said, no, you're incorrect. And so I apologized, and he came back and said, meh, it's all good, and just we all motor on.
Yeah, James Gunn, look at you, not flamethrowing people on Twitter, James. Very nice.
There we go. What a guy.
What a guy. So, awesome. Very good. That's nice to hear, too.
It is.
Also, Jim, Festival of the Lion King's full show returns July 16th. That's good. It's also important because the current version, celebration of the essence of what was once the Festival of the Lion King, I may have... That's the title, right, Jim?
I think there's a few more parenthetical phrases. Now including monkeys and birds.
Colon the ride.
There we go. There we go.
Anyway, the current version of the show, which lacks a number of elements, including some of the acrobats, the dancers, and the songs, is rated anywhere from half a point to a full point lower than the full version, according to our reader surveys. So if the full show is rated around 4.5 stars, which it is traditionally by all age groups, the current version is anywhere from 3.5 to 4 stars for some groups. Yeah, so that's important, right? It's definitely a lesser show when people think that. So it'll be good to see it coming back full strength middle of July.
Absolutely.
All right. Jim, we have time for a couple of listener questions. Here's one from Candace, who's interested in buying DVC, but only if annual passes are available. So Candace said she called the Disney Vacation Club directly and asked them about annual passes. She says, the rep told me that they're not offering annual passes, but did say the word yet, and I think that slipped, Candace says. I said, so you're bringing them back at some point? And he said that he's not been communicated to them, despite what his assumptions are, which he wouldn't point blank tell Candace. He said that buyers of DVC have to purchase tickets like everyone else, and also offered that since you're saving so much on deluxe accommodations, you can afford to buy regular passes, not annual passes. I think, Jim, that's a little bit of a stretch. Also, Candace called a couple of other resale places and basically said in California, annual pass holders are filing a class action lawsuit claiming that they were unable to use their passes due to limited reservation availability, and that Disney didn't want that scenario to become a problem at Walt Disney World. I'm assuming, Jim, there presumably that's with DVC people. Like, we can't use our DVC because we can't afford to go to the, or we can't get reservations in the park. So everybody expects the passes to come back, but nobody knows when.
Okay.
I will say this, though. I mean, Jim, do you think DVC sales are taking a hit because people can't buy annual passes to go along with them?
What makes me crazy is that DVC was targeted for the most passionate, the most dedicated Disney fans. These are the folks who will come back every year. These aren't the save-for-a-lifetime people or come-back-every-3 or 4 year people.
Yeah.
And Disney is making it difficult for these folks to get back to the resort. I can't wrap my mind around that, because these are the ones who evangelize to friends and family about, oh, you want to be a DVC member, you want to buy points, you want to get into this particular resort. And it's hard to imagine what they're telling their friends and family right now.
I made a 40-year commitment and can't get into the parks. That seems like a difficult value proposition.
So much of what Disney is doing lately just is so short-sighted. It's just sort of like, it makes this quarter look good, but let's jump ahead 5 years here, 10 years.
Two things, Jim. I don't think the current management thinks that far ahead. And two, I don't think the current management's going to be here in 5 or 10 years. That's not their concern.
I'm hoping your crystal ball holds out, Len.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the things that they've done in the last couple of years are unsustainable over the long term, just based on the feedback that we're getting. So something has to change, and they just know it. So,
true.
All right. A letter from Christopher, who says, Len and Jim, the attraction downtime statistics on last week's show were illuminating. I must say, though, that downtime is only part of the problem. When the attractions are running, many are running at far less than optimal show quality. It's not that there's a lot of downtime because they want to be sure every effect is working all the time. There's a lot of downtime, and the attractions are still running with broken effects. Rise of the Resistance with the guns not moving, or the final Kylo Ren animatronic behind a wall, is like getting a poorly cooked steak at a restaurant or a movie going black for minutes in the middle. When we rode Dinosaur, not a single animatronic was moving, not one. And at the point where they take your photo, the big dinosaur on the right was gone, and there was literally a dinosaur head on a stick on the left. These are just two examples, but there were many more. The downtime is quantifiable, but the broken effects are just as concerning. Jim's right. The bill has come due for Walt Disney World. My concern is that it'll be sent to collections. I've actually heard about the dinosaur thing. And I mean, so Christopher mentioned it, but I've gotten a number of emails from people who are like, what is up with the show quality here, especially in Dinosaur, which, to be honest, is not a top-tier attraction at Animal Kingdom. But the idea that all of the animatronics are broken and nobody's decided to fix them. Jim, it goes back to the fact that you can't close the ride to fix them because there's not enough capacity in Animal Kingdom to go along with it, right?
Where's the incentive? I mean, Expedition Everest, the Yeti has been broken for a decade and a half at this point. And the notion is, well, you're going by in a ride vehicle and there's lights and the scenery and that sort of thing. And okay, they're not moving, but you're moving. Why are you complaining? I feel like they didn't complain about the Yeti. They're not going to complain about the animatronics and Dinosaur. Let it go.
Yeah, there's a point. There's a point at which, though, the broken animatronics become a concern. I mean, if none of them are working on Dinosaur, it's betcha. And I would say this, you know, if it was, if it's not important to have them working, why did they work in the first place?
Excellent point.
And why did they work for? I mean, I don't know how, I can't remember how old Dinosaur is, but let's say it's, you know, 15 years old. If it worked for the last 14 and a half years and you put money into making it work, why stop now?
True.
Yeah. All right. Next email from Jeremy, who says, after you talked about it on a recent show, I watched Disney's The Black Hole and noticed the sound effects used for the blasters in the movie sound similar to the sound effects in Buzz Lightyear's Space Ranger Spin. I discovered that Michael from ProgressCityUSA.com shared concept art from Imagineering that made for a possible black hole attraction that appeared to have the same blaster concepts and look similar to Buzz Lightyear. And Jim, I've actually added the concept art to our show notes. We'll include it in our show notes as well. Is it possible, Jeremy asks, that they used the sound effects from blasters from the black hole in Buzz Lightyear? What a deep cut reference, if true.
No doubt. Disney is famous for, you know, I'm sure Jimmy McDonald and his sound team at Disney, who were infamous, you know, and they built up one of the great sound effects libraries in Hollywood. You know, I'm sure when the Imagineers were looking for a sound to use in Buzz Lightyear, or Astro Blasters, or Space Ranger Spin, whichever version of the attraction we're talking about, they're Disney fans just like us. So they would have gone into the library, probably found that, and dropped it into the Buzz shooter, just because, again, it's like, oh, a tribute to Jimmy. This is cool.
More importantly, stuff we don't have to pay for, because it's already been paid for.
Even better. That said, though, the concept art that Jeremy was kind enough to send along that Michael had put up at Progress City, this isn't actually the black hole attraction. This is the Little Green Men shooter ride. Oh, in fact, this version of the attraction was the one that was supposed to be built inside of the Carousel of Progress building. I mean, the notion that a UFO had landed at Disneyland, and it's like, oh my God, all of these little green men that are inside the spaceship are going to get out. You get inside there and kill them. That's what I want to do with my family at a theme park. It's like, oh, we come in peace. Boom. Well, now you're in pieces. Okay, there we go.
All right, folks, when we come back, Jim gives us the history of Walter Cronkite's narration of Spaceship Earth, as well as other celebrities in Epcot. And remember that Walter Cronkite's narration started this week back in 1986, and also what Epcot was attempting in this first makeover. We'll be right back.
I got some very good advice a few years back from a good, close family friend, which was to talk to my parents while I still could. And by that, I mean not just one of those how was your day, how have you been, polite but not very terribly in-depth conversations, but to ask your parents real questions, learn what you can while you can, because there will come a time when these sorts of conversations just aren't possible anymore. I learned that the hard way when I lost my own dad 18 months ago. Still doesn't seem real. I miss him every day. More to the point, I feel bad that my daughter Alice won't ever get to know her grandfather as well as I did. My dad was a hell of a great storyteller. Which is why I'm so glad a few years back, when my father was still in good health, I signed him up for Storyworth. Storyworth is its online service that helps you and your dad, or the father figure in your life, connect through sharing stories and memories and preserving them for years yet to come. The way Storyworth works is, every week, this online service emails your dad a thought-provoking question of your choice that comes from this vast pool of possible options. Each unique prompt asks questions like, what was your fondest childhood memory, or have you ever feared for your life? My dad did this, dutifully answering each query that Storyworth sent him, and after a year had passed, this online service then compiled all the questions my dad had answered and then took these stories, along with some photos my dad had shared, and turned that material into a beautiful keepsake book. I have to tell you, it has become quite the comfort over the past year or so. I find myself cracking that thing open every now and then and laughing as my father recounts a tale from his misspent youth back when he and his family lived in Dorchester, Mass., and he was a member of that infamous teenage bike gang, the Shamrocks. Look, I know, Father's Day is coming up shortly, which is when we all typically spring for the cliched gifts like ties or coffee mugs that read, World's Greatest Dad. But if you really want to honor your father or the father figure in your life, give them the gift you'll both cherish for years yet to come. And that's Storyworth. Right now, for a limited time, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/DisneyDish. That's storyworth.com/DisneyDish to save $10 on your first purchase. Storyworth.com/DisneyDish. We thank them for sponsoring today's show.
Before we get started, I wanted to point out that there are many great videos of the Walter Cronkite version of Spaceship Earth on YouTube. I want to give a shout out to our friend Martin, Martin's Videos, who has both audio and video from the 1986 Spaceship Earth redo. Visit tinyurl.com/SSE1986, all one word, to see it. All right, Jim. So, celebrities and Epcot Center is sort of the general umbrella thing we're talking about today.
Speaking of which, are you familiar with the musical Chicago?
I'm not, actually. Laurel is, I'm not.
Well, Fred Ebb and John Kander wrote a great song for that show called Razzle Dazzle, which talks about how you can literally get away with murder, provided, of course, you put on a good show first. And Razzle Dazzle has some great lyrics. Given an act with lots of flash in it, and the reaction will be passionate. Given the old hocus pocus, bead and feather them, how can they see with sequins in their eyes? Now, but to start off today's show, I want to share one particular key couplet from the show tune, which is, throw them a fake and a finagle, they'll never know that you're a bagel.
I mean, how many words really rhyme with finagle, Jim?
This is why I love Conjure Nap. But anyway, it's September of 1984. Michael Eisner has just been installed, new head of the Walt Disney Company. Right. And one of Michael's very first duties is to fix Epcot, which is about to celebrate its second anniversary of its grand opening. Okay. Now, mind you, no one in management at Walt Disney World much feels like celebrating, especially given that attendance levels at Epcot are definitely declining. And the problem is the word has gotten out among the theme park going public that Epcot Center, while beautifully designed and incredibly well-meaning, is a bagel. Not an everything bagel, not a poppy seed bagel, like, you know, just a plain, ordinary bagel. And now Michael Eisner needs to find a way to make this bagel seem not so plain. Michael Eisner came to Disney from Paramount, which was the hottest studio in Hollywood in the early 1980s. And when Michael Eisner had a genuinely terrible movie back during his days at Paramount, and take, for example, Staying Alive. Do you remember this,
Len? The sequel to Saturday Night Fever?
Saturday Night Fever, yes. Right. Okay. Staying Alive was so terrible. It has the distinction of being the oldest film on Rotten Tomatoes to get a zero freshness rating.
Oof, really?
Literally, that means there are no good reviews anywhere for the Sylvester Stallone film. By the way, that's right. Wait. I said Sylvester Stallone.
Sylvester Stallone?
John Travolta may have been the star of the movie, reprising his role as Tony Manero from Saturday Night Fever, but Sylvester Stallone not only directed this movie, Len, he also co-wrote and co-produced it. And again, look, I don't know, Len, if you're thinking modern, you know, movie musical, the first name that comes to mind, of course, is Sylvester Stallone.
Okay, so here's my question, Jim.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Frank Stallone, Sylvester Stallone's brother, was actually a singer who had...
And he had the hit single from the Staying Alive soundtrack.
Oh, really?
Len,
it was
yes.
him?
It was him.
I was like,
okay.
Did they just get the wrong Stallone in the Rolodex? Like, what?
No. If anything, to give Sly credit, you know, as soon as he landed this gig, it's like, Frank, hey, you want to do something for the soundtrack?
Okay, but why did they pick Sylvester? I mean, I know he had Rocky back in 76, and he won all kinds of awards for that, and that's, you know, legitimately a great movie. And then he did, you know, Rocky II, which was also good. But
well, you know, again, you got to look at this from the Michael Eisner side of the fence. In fact, this is the genius part of Staying Alive, because, again, when he sees a rough cut of the movie, and it's a disaster, but it's out ahead of the July 1983 release date. But Michael decides in this situation, the best defense is a good offense. First of all, he books Staying Alive on over 1,600 screens nationwide. He then sends Stallone and Travolta out on this giant publicity tour where they appear on every morning news show and every late night talk show. And it works. The very reason that, you know, he greenlit this production, it's like Stallone's name's on it, Travolta's name's on it. People are going to show up for this. It has the biggest opening weekend for a modern movie musical. It sells $12 million worth of tickets. Mm-hmm. That record held for 9 years, Len, only when Disney's animated Aladdin came out in 92.
Okay. So $12 million in 1983 money is $35 million. So that would not be a great opening weekend now, but for a modern movie musical, which is a subgenre, okay.
But he knew that if you use celebrity in the right way, it could turn around the public's perception of a project, at least initially. So now it's Epcot Center, which the public thinks of as earnest, educational, and maybe not as entertaining as it could be. So the quickest fix is to throw a few celebrities at this theme park.
We're going from Sylvester Stallone to Walter Cronkite, and this is Michael Eisner's idea of celebrity.
This is. But again, where do you start? You start with the Theseus attraction, the 180-foot tall geodesic globe. The very first thing that guests encounter at the end of the park, also typically the first thing people come in the door and get on. But here's the thing. Who did Disney get to initially narrate the Theseus attraction? The big show business name for this you know, the park, Vic Perrin. Now, there's going to be a short pause here for those of you who need to say who.
Exactly.
By the way, this is a variation on Jack Benny. When he made his radio debut in 1932, he literally opened his first show with, "This is Jack Benny talking. There will now be a short pause while you say, 'Who cares?'" So
that is one of the greatest intros of all time.
I love it.
You know what's funny is because like when I'm doing, you know, presentations over Zoom and stuff like that, I'm cognizant that I talk fast, right? And I tend to pack presentations with a lot of information, right? So I'll periodically say, you know, okay, and now I'm going to pause for questions. But now I think I'm going to say, and now I will pause for you guys to say, "Who cares?"
All right. So Jack Benny lives on. I love that. I love it. Okay. Now, mind you, Vic Perrin, look, if you're a fan of the original Star Trek series, maybe you caught Perrin's brief appearances on that legendary TV show. He played the two Tharns in Mirror Mirror, also the voice of Nomad and the Changeling. But seriously, if you know your 1960s sci-fi television, maybe you remember Perrin from The Outer Limits. This was ABC's response to the success of Twilight Zone, which aired over on CBS. At the start of that show, Outer Limits, Vic's voice was the one you heard. There's a, "There is nothing wrong with your television set. We control the horizontal."
Is that where that's from?
There we go.
Oh my God, that's been copied so many times.
It has. And the theory is that Vic got this gig for, and remember, he didn't just narrate Spaceship Earth, but he also narrated Universe of Energy. The theory is there was a senior member of Imagineering management who really liked Star Trek or really liked Outer Limits. So he hired Perrin to be the voice of two future world attractions that sat side by side. And I've always wondered about people who went to the original version of Epcot Center, who after they finished Spaceship Earth went over to Universe of Energy, and it's like, the Outer Limits guy? Again?
I love the idea that the Imagineers had enough leeway that they could hire their favorite voice actors.
Again, it was a different timeline.
Because if it was me, Spaceship Earth would now be narrated by the guy who does Dr. Doofenshmirtz. Wouldn't that be? And now, Jim, I need to hire some voice talent because I'm going to redo the entire thing.
Oh, that is Dan Povenmire, and he's a wonderful – he actually once sent me a voicemail in Doofenshmirtz's voice, basically, "What's it going to take to get good coverage on Jim Hill Media? Who do I have to talk to?"
I think we can work something out.
Yeah.
We need to kickstart crowdfund this idea. All right, go ahead.
Absolutely. All right, but no disrespect to Vic Perrin, but Mr. Perrin, at least as far as Michael Eisner was concerned, wasn't really a name. And Michael was looking to make Epcot Center suddenly seem sexy, exciting, you know, and so he felt, look, the thesis direction for the park needs a name narrator, you know, someone that the guests would immediately recognize from the very first second the narration got underway. But who could that be? We have to jump back to summer of 85. Walt Disney Productions decides they're going to revive the Sunday night anthology television series. They cut a deal with ABC. This is the show that Walt himself hosted right up until his death in December of 66. And so the thinking was that if we're bringing this show back, we need an MC. We need a host. But at the same time, it's got to be somebody that's not Walt equivalent, but Walt adjacent.
Yeah.
So they put together a dream casting list. And first on the list is Dick Van Dyke, because it's like, oh, well, you know, come on. Dick's associated with Mary Poppins and beloved sitcom, and, you know, he'd be perfect. Likewise, Danny Kaye, though Danny at this point was kind of on Disney's mayored list because of what he did during the opening television special for Epcot Center. He was kind of a jerk.
Okay.
If you've ever seen the TV special, there's a moment where Danny is directing the West Point Choir. I mean, you have all of these young men in their gray uniform, and they're singing a patriotic song, and Danny's on like this lift high above, you know, the group directing them. Mm-hmm. And it was a camera shot that took hours to set up, and it's ending the show, and Danny deliberately at the height of the song drops his pants on camera. And Dick Nudis got so mad at him, it was like he sent a golf cart, and it's like, get that guy off my resort.
Yeah. The golf cart just ended up driving on I-4 for a while.
Here we go. On the other hand, Eisner also insisted that Peter Graves from Mission Impossible.
Surely you're joking.
Well, no, that's actually why he wanted him. Airplane was made at Paramount, and Peter Graves had been so sweet and so funny and so personable. Michael Eisner's like, no, he's a great guy. We should definitely get him.
I mean, his voice is very resonant. It's an
immediate authority figure. But
I would love for Peter Graves to say, as you're going into the papyrus scene, have any of you ever been in an Egyptian prison? Well, I know it's Turkey, but still. Turkish person.
Do you like gladiator movies? Exactly. All right.
All right.
Anyway, but again, this is all. Eisner wants a Sunday Night movie on ABC to be perceived as important. But so you need a really big name to be the host of this revival. Sure. Someone like, say, the most trusted man in America. And when you said that in the mid-1980s, that there was only one person who came to mind. And that was legendary newsman Walter Cronkite, who had stepped down in March of 1981 as the anchor of the CBS Evening News after a 19-year run, replaced by Dan Rather, who actually had a longer run at that show, 24 years. But now, okay, it's 4 years after Walter's effectively retired, and he's kind of kept his hand in. He's done a series of documentaries about World War II, which, given that, I mean, Walter was actually on the ground in the North American and European theater while the war was going on. So, this is a guy who could speak with authority about, you know, what went on during the war years. But the question is, and that begins airing in 83, but now the question is, well, how do we get a hold of this nearly 70-year-old guy? You know, ask him to come in and audition for the Sunday Night movie. And this is when Roy E. Disney steps up and says, leave it to me. I get it, because Roy E. was an enthusiastic sailor. He knew that Cronkite shared this passion. So Roy E. arranges a trip out to Martha's Vineyard, which is where Walter and his wife have retired to. And then through friends, I bumped into Walter Cronkite, and floats the offer to him. And Cronkite is genuinely flattered. He has huge respect for the Disney organization, but as he tells Roy, it's, look, I'm retired now. I don't want the hassle of coming into work on a weekly show. And besides, Walt Disney is kind of a tough act to follow. So he politely but firmly turns down the hosting gig. And then almost by default, Michael Eisner becomes the MC host of the Disney Sunday Night movie, which by Michael's own admission, he was initially terrible at. In fact, Eisner's wife, Jane, you know, her notes were like, you're terrible on camera. You're awkward. You're stiff. But Michael keeps at it. He hires Michael Kay, who is this political consultant who specialized in taking politicians who were terrible on camera and making them look natural and folksy. And over time, he got Michael better at that gig. But back to Walter Cronkite now. The company's opened a line of communications with the most trusted man in America. And the question now is, how do we take advantage of this? I mean, it's clear from what Walter told Roy E. He's not willing to take on a full-time gig at this time, but what about a project that take up a day or so of Walter Cronkite's schedule? And so this is when Michael Eisner is looking to bedazzle Epcot Center, you know, insert a few celebrities here and there. And remember, this is 85, 86. Company's already announced its deal with Michael Jackson and George Lucas.
Okay. So this is part of an overall campaign. Okay.
Yeah, and again, in just a few months will result in the opening of Captain EO, a 3D movie. But Captain EO is woefully behind schedule. They began shooting it in July of 85. It was supposed to open in the parks for the summer of 86, but they're so far behind on the effects work that it's like, look, we're not going to make Memorial Day. We may make Labor Day.
Oh, geez.
But it's just one of these things where if you want somebody to promote for the summer of 86, good luck. It's not us. And so at this point, it's like, well, wait a minute. What if we bring in Walter Cronkite to re-record Vic Perrin's narration for Spaceship Earth? It gives Eisner what he's looking for. You know, he wants his celebrities, and it gives Epcot a little more star power. It gives us something we can talk up for the summer of 86, yep. And then we get EO for the fall. And so it's like, okay, they contact Cronkite. He quickly agrees to the gig. Another reason why you have to seek out Martin's excellent documentary for Spaceship Earth is the fact that if you listen to the Vic Perrin narration, this is a set of shows that we did for Bandcamp about Joseph Mankiewicz.
And the rape bribery script we went through, which was really poetic.
That's it exactly. In fact, this is how the Ray Bradbury version. And in fact, if you rode Spaceship Earth from 82 to late winter, early spring of 86, this is how it opened. It's, where have we come from? Where are we going? In the dust from which we were formed, answers recorded on the walls of time. So let us now journey into that past to seek those walls and to know ourselves and to probe the destiny of our spaceship Earth. And now, suns reverse, moons rephrase, let us return to ancient caves where first we learned how to share our thoughts and to survive. Now, here is how the Walter Cronkite version of the opening Spaceship Earth, which starts, Len, with an actual introduction. You step into your ride vehicle, you sit down, and this is a female voice saying, AT&T welcomes you to Spaceship Earth and invites you to explore the story of communications. Mm-hmm. And now, your host, Walter Cronkite. And then, in the distinct voice that we, you know, all of us baby boomers knew. For eons, our planet has drifted as a spaceship through the universe, and for a brief moment, we have been its passengers. Yet in that time, we've made tremendous progress in our ability to record and share knowledge. So now, let's journey back 40,000 years to the dawn of recorded history. So far less poetry, more put the hay down where the goats can get at it style narration. And Walter records his narration April of 1986. Imagineer spend the next few weeks editing the recording and doing the final mix. And once that's done, this feature wheel attraction briefly closes to allow installation of this new material. And when I say briefly, Len, we're talking 3 days.
Yeah.
May 26th through May 28th, 1986. On the 29th, the very first guests climb across their ride vehicles at the base of Spaceship Earth. And here, Walter Cronkite is the new narrator of the feature wheel attraction. And in those three days, they were able to do a couple of additional tweaks to the ride. There was, it used to be when you went up the first load hill in the leg of Spaceship Earth, mm-hmm. before you got to the caveman scene, they had a fog machine. So the idea is you were literally passing through the mists of time.
The mists of time, exactly.
There we go.
Was that just too on the nose, or was there a problem with the smoke machine?
There were certain folks who went to guest relations and said, I have emphysema, and maybe that wasn't a good choice. So what they did is they pulled out the fog machine and replaced it with twinkle lights, which were supposed to represent the stars, we're passing backward through time. At the very, very top of the ride track, just before the network operation scene, they added two still tableaus. Just in 4 years' time, things had changed in the computing world. So off to the left side of the track, they shoehorned in a scene where a woman is sitting working in a paperless office. Mm. Remember the idea of the paperless office,
Len? I vaguely remember it back when I first started going to work in the late 80s, that the idea was like, oh, you know, we're going to be paperless soon. And soon is, I guess, coming up. Eventually.
2023.
Exactly.
Okay. And on the right side of the track, they had a scene with a boy in his bedroom looking at a personal computer.
Now, what scenes are there now? Like, where was this?
I will have to go take a look.
I mean, I know it's in Martin's video because I remember seeing it, but I couldn't remember if they were eventually replaced by other scenes or if they're just no longer there.
The thing, talking with Imagineers who've worked on Spaceship Earth, it's the modern-day scenes that they consider the most frustrating, because mm-hmm. it's like literally the moment you put the tech in 3 months, it's out of date.
Something's better, yeah.
Yeah, and the notion of people will be going by this same show scene for 10, 15 years, and it's like, oh, can we get a monitor in there that isn't the size of a washing machine?
Exactly. You know, a cathode ray tube, a CRT monitor.
There we go. And anyway, a final ad. You used to descend the attraction in the dark with mm-hmm. Tomorrow's Child playing. And the notion was to do this in the dark, facing backwards, seemed a little grim. So what they did is they went out and got all of these photographs of happy children.
I remember this part, yeah.
They printed it on plexiglass and lit from behind. So mm-hmm. at least as you're going down, oh, Tomorrow's Child, and there they are, and they're so happy, you know, and you're leaving the ride. But this is all they could do in 3 days.
For 3 days? That's not bad.
No. And certainly when you think about the next redo for Spaceship Earth, the Jeremy Irons retake, at that time they were closed from August 15th through November 23rd, 1994. So 3 months. So bigger, much bigger change. But Cronkite really enjoyed working at Spaceship Earth, so much so that when the Imagers reached out just 2 years later and asked Walter if he'd be willing to be paired with Rob Williams to serve as the co-host of The Magic of Disney Animation, which was, again, being built for the then still under construction Disney Jam Studio Tour, Cronkite immediately says yes. Walter really didn't get Robin Williams' off-the-wall sense of humor.
I'm sure it was coming at Walter very, very fast.
It was. In fact, there's this great behind-the-scenes kind of blooper reel of sorts that's out really? There for the Magic of Disney Animation, and it shows a lot of alternate jokes that Robin tried out for this attraction, which are immediately followed by Walter Crichton looking at him like, "You're an idiot." You know, it's just sort of like, why would you say that?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. But anyway, back to summer of 86, guest surveys taken between June and July of that year show that guests thought having Walter Cronkite as the narrator of Spaceship Earth was a huge positive. Approval ratings for this feature-able attraction reportedly went up by 15% just based on Cronkite's name recognition.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah. But let's be honest here, maybe a less flowery version of narration helped.
Oh, it's a good point. Yeah. Make the language simpler for people to understand. Yeah, okay.
There we go. All right, Captain EO opened September of that same year. And again, also wows Epcot Center visitors. And at that point, Michael Eisner's like, yep, this is how we fix this. We're going to bedazzle Future World with celebrities. So, by the way, just before we started the show today, Len, I sent you an image of the cover of Disney News Magazine from the fall of 89 that was done.
Cranium Command.
There we go. But look closely at Cranium Command, because this image that they were using to promote the show is different from the finished attraction in that all of the characters that we see inside of the little boy's brain are animated.
Right.
The finished version of the attraction, first of all, how many members of the cast of Saturday Night Live? I mean, Dana Carvey, John Lovitz.
Yeah, basically, let's just go to New York. We'll go to Rockefeller Center. We'll find everybody we know.
Yeah, what they decided to do is, instead of the animated vignettes, they got Charles Grodin to be the right side of the brain. They got John Lovitz to be left side. My personal favorite, Bobcat Goldthwait, is the nervous system.
Still alive.
Still with us. This is the pavilion where they leaned way too heavily into celebrities. I mean, think about it. Martin Short stars in the Making of Me film. You have Tim Matheson from Animal House and Elizabeth Shue from Space Camp star in Body Wars, which, by the way, the ride film was directed by Mr. Spock himself, Leonard Nimoy. And Len, at that point, Epcot embraces celebrities and never looks back.
Wow.
And that's all thanks to Walter Cronkite and Roy E. Disney just coincidentally bumping into him on the dock at Martha's Vineyard.
That is fantastic. So you mentioned George Wendt, and this was 86 when did they cast George Wendt?
I want to say the Wonders of Life Pavilion opens October of 89, which is 5 or 6 months.
So Cheers had been on the air for a while at that point.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he was a great stomach. I'm sending this stuff back up. You know, it's like, it was very, very enjoyable. Though at that point, previous year, 1988, was when Mickey was celebrating his 60th birthday. And right. There was an hour-long special that aired on NBC that actually features Mickey, and the problem is, the conceit of the special is that Mickey is missing, but nobody recognizes that it's this 3-foot-tall rodent when he keeps walking into NBC sitcoms. And at one point, you are actually on the set of Cheers. This is a 5-minute-long bit, Len, where, you know, Mickey walks into Cheers, and he's sitting down next to Cliff and Norm. And, you know, it's like, what became of Mickey Mouse? Yeah, what became of him?
Mickey Mouse in a bar. That's interesting.
Mickey Mouse in a bar, yeah. So he had been on Disney's radar up until that point. And so it's like, ooh, okay, yeah, if we can get George, he'd make a great stomach. Let's do it.
Oh, that would be a great stomach.
There we go.
You know, when I look at you, I think of the digestive system. How do you open that conversation?
You know, it's interesting. Nancy was just saying the other day that I reminded her of the opposite end of the digestive system. But
wasn't going to go there, Jim. Left it for you.
There we go. Okay.
All right. That's a great show. All right, folks. That's going to do it for the Disney Dish show today. Please head on over to disneydish.bandcamp.com, where you'll find exclusive shows never before heard on iTunes. You can find more of Jim at jimhalemedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We're produced fabulously by Aaron Adams, who will be sharing samples of great-great-granduncle Abraham's Fireside Cobbler, whose secret ingredient is love and moonshine, at the 72nd Annual Louisiana Peach Festival on Saturday, June 4th, starting at 9 a.m. on Park Avenue in beautiful downtown Ruston, Louisiana. While Aaron's doing that, please go into iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.